a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
House Judiciary will now come to order. Just a reminder, if you're going to testify today, please sign in at the back by the podium by the door. Welcome to the Internet listeners, and reminder to turn your cell phones off or turn them on silent for the committee hearing this morning. Welcome to the two pages of seniors in high school who are helping us today. Please come forward to the microphone and introduce yourselves one at a time. Tell us your name and what school you go to.
Hi, I'm Emily Wall, and I go to Chamberlain High School.
Welcome, Emily. Thank you for being here. And the other page.
I'm Landon Fanning. I go to Lyman,
thank you for being here. And was the microphone on?
No.
Okay, go ahead and say it again.
I'm Landon Fanning. I go to Lyman High School.
Okay, thank you for being here. And reminder, if you have handouts for the committee, please distribute them through the pages. At this point, I had the secretary call the roll.
Representatives Wink.
Here.
Killer. Feinstein.
Here.
Gibson. Hoffman.
Here.
Magstead.
Here.
Kopp.
Here.
Erickson.
Here.
Stevens.
Here.
Johns.
Here.
Hayek.
Here.
Hansen.
Here.
Gosch.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum. Thank you, Madam Secretary. At this time, I'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll move. Second.
Moved by Representative Hansen, seconded by Representative Wink. Those in favor of approving the minutes will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. On today's agenda, we're going to move things around a little bit. We're going to hear first House Bill 1074, which is currently second on the agenda. And then the second bill we are going to hear is Senate Bill 63. After that, we will follow the agenda in the order of the bills that appear currently. So the third bill will be House Bill 1073, fourth bill will be House Bill 1092, and the fifth bill will be Senate Bill 37. So with that, we'll take proponent testimony on House Bill 1074, an act to define the insurer's responsibilities concerning health insurance policies for newborns or newly adopted children. Proponent testimony, Representative Rounds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to the esteemed members of the House Judiciary Committee. Representative Tim Rounds, District 24, Pierce, South Dakota. I'm bringing you House Bill 1074. Currently, South Dakota statute allows the insurer to require notice from an insured that the insured has a newborn or newly adopted child that is to be added to coverage. The insurance company must provide reasonable notice to the insured of the need to alter their coverage from single or spousal coverage if they want their newborn or newly adopted child to be covered. 1074 recognizes that some insurance companies automatically cover newborns or newly adopted children without requiring notice and do not collect or track demographic information on the children. House Bill 1074 would require the insurer in those cases to take reasonable steps to provide adequate notice of the insured's responsibility to notify the insurer when they are no longer have any children eligible for dependent coverage. This bill will go on to spell out what will constitute reasonable steps in notifying the insured and their obligation under the policy. We have some others that are going to testify this morning, so I will step back and be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rounds. Further proponent testimony, House Bill 1074.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Roger Tellinghusen. I appear this morning as the registered lobbyist for AFLAC. This bill is really brought at the request of AFLAC. We'd like to thank Representative Rounds for bringing the bill. It's a bill that we've worked together with the Division of Insurance and Crafting. And just to give you a little background, as Representative Rounds indicated, under current law, insurance companies that sell a family policy to, or excuse me, sell a single or a spousal policy to a couple, may require that they be notified when the couple has children that are born or adopted that the couple wants to have covered by a family policy. The insured must give notice to the insurance company. The law requires that the insurance company must prominently display on the material that's provided to the insured a notice of their obligation to let the insurance company know when they have children that they want to have coverage for. This is all tied into the ability then to assess the proper premium. Aflac has just a different business model. If Aflac sells a family policy to a couple, it doesn't matter how many children they have, how many children they adopt. They're automatically covered under their policy. But as there is, becomes no longer children that are eligible for coverage, in order for the couple to receive a reduction in their premium, they need to let Aflac know that they no longer have children eligible for coverage. So this bill is really just the mirror opposite, if you will, of the existing law, in that it would require companies like Aflac to prominently display in their written material that they provide to the insured notice that they have to let us know when they no longer have children eligible for coverage. And then the appropriate adjustment to premiums can be made. That's all the bill does, and I'd be happy to stand by for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Talley. Is in further proponent testimony, House Bill 1074.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Randy Moses, Department of Labor and Regulation, Division of Insurance. Roger is certainly correct. We did work closely with Aflac in crafting this legislation. I might just add a couple of little items that he didn't cover. The way that things are in the current law kind of puts Aflac in a catch-22 situation because they're required to refund premiums when there's no longer any coverage being provided, but yet they don't have any data on these children and no way to do it. And so we recognize that problem that they had. The only other solution would be to completely change their business model and require them to incur a lot of extra costs. Rather, we worked out this solution where we are allowing their business procedure to go forward, but with the added protection of some additional notices to consumers, both at the time of application and in the policy documents. We think that's a good balanced approach to make sure consumers have adequate notice of their obligations and allows Aflac to continue their current business model. And with that, we'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moses. Any further proponent testimony, House Bill 1074? Seeing none, any opponent testimony, House Bill 1074? Any opponent testimony? Seeing none, I believe you'll waive rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Of course. We'll move to questions from the committee. Any questions from the committee members? Representative Feinstein.
Mr. Chair, I guess Mr. Tellinghusen, please. I have three or four questions sort of all go together, and I'll just sort of throw them at you. What is the problem if you're not notified? I'm trying to get a handle on that. Who or what happens? And what have you been doing so far, and what extra costs have you incurred so far?
Mr. Chair, with respect to what happens if you're not notified, under the traditional model, if you will, that's covered by current law, if the insurance company is not notified of children who are eligible for coverage, there's a question whether they would be covered. Under the Aflac model, because there's automatic coverage, if Aflac's not notified that children are no longer eligible for coverage, you may continue paying a premium, a higher premium than you would otherwise have to pay.
You need to follow up.
Okay, so that I didn't catch that originally. So your premium does change relative to the number of children.
That's correct.
Okay,
in fact, Mr. Chair, Representative Feinstein, I would also point out the language beginning on line 14 of the bill. It says, upon receipt of a notice that a dependent is no longer eligible, the insurer shall adjust the coverage accordingly and, if applicable, return to the insured any unearned premium.
Any other questions for the committee? Representative Hayek.
Thank you. Roger, I'm kind of curious in that the new, my kids are well past this age, but with the law now, they can stay on the parents' policy up to, I believe, age 26. Is that correct? Or,
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding, Representative Hayek.
And may I follow up?
Sure.
And so there are going to be situations where the individual, the student, we will say, would be eligible to stay on the parents' insurance, but may have gotten employed somewhere where they are covered on a health insurance policy. And then if notification is not made to AFLAC, what kind of situation? We're talking a double coverage, and how is that impacted, if at all, by this law?
Mr. Chair, first of all, I think it's important to keep in mind what type of insurance AFLAC sells. It doesn't sell traditional health insurance. It sells supplemental insurance. I don't think you're going to see the overlap unless, of course, the student the child who becomes employed signs up for additional AFLAC coverage through their employer. I don't think the likelihood of that situation coming up is very great, if that makes any sense to you. I mean, the types of coverages that AFLAC provides are not traditional health insurance. It's a supplemental benefit that's paid directly to the insured.
Any follow-up?
May I?
Mm-hmm.
Then this does not, of course, refer just to AFLAC, so we do talk about other insurers and what impact, if any, maybe Mr. Moses, would it have on those particular companies?
Mr. Chair,
yeah, go ahead.
Representative Hayek, I'm not aware of other companies that have the same business model that AFLAC has. Even though we refer to other insurance companies, I believe this bill is probably more germane to AFLAC than any others that I'm aware of. But I'm sure Mr. Moses could clarify that for me.
Mr. Moses looks like he wants to jump in on this, so if you may.
I sure can. Thanks, Randy Moses again. Responding to the question, if you will. First of all, the dependent to 26 stuff that you referred to, that really doesn't apply to AFLAC supplemental coverages. I believe those would be accepted benefits and wouldn't even have that requirement in the first place. But nonetheless, there are, as far as other companies who may have this, we are aware that they are not the only company that has this type of practice. But again, we're talking supplemental type products and not your major medical comprehensive coverage that I believe you're referring to, Representative.
Thank you. Any other questions of the committee or action or discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I move do pass on House Bill 1074.
Second.
Moved by Representative Hoffman, seconded by Representative Hayek. Any comments on your motion, Representative Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's been explained very well. I think it's good legislation. I think it's actually benefiting the individual who owns the policy. Thank you very much.
Further comments by committee? Seeing none, those in favor of the do pass motion will say aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Representatives Wink.
Aye.
Killer.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hoffman.
Aye.
Magstead.
Aye.
Kopp.
Aye.
Erickson.
Aye.
Stevens.
Aye.
Johns.
Aye.
Hayek.
Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
Gosch.
Aye.
That's 13 ayes, 0 nays.
House Bill 1074 will go to the floor of the do pass recommendation. Good questions by the committee. Thank you, Representative. We'll now move to Senate Bill 63, revise certain requirements for certified public accountant firms licensed in South Dakota. Proponent testimony on Senate Bill 63. Mr. Lynn.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is J.J. Lynn. I'm with the Department of Labor and Regulation. Today on Senate Bill 63 is an act to revise certain requirements for certified public accounting firms. Senate Bill 63 will streamline the CPA firm licensure process by simplifying reporting, eliminating tracking of employees, and removing multiple office location reporting. Senate Bill 63 will allow the board to pass rules to create a tier-based system of firm fees based on the number of owners in the firm. Senate Bill 63 will ease the requirements of receiving and maintaining a firm license while maintaining accountability for CPA firms practicing in South Dakota. I request your support for Senate Bill 63 and will stand by for any questions you may have. Thank you,
Mr. Lynn. Further proponent testimony in House Bill 63. Mr. Mann.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Larry Mann, registered lobbyist, South Dakota CPA Society. Just wanted to let you know that we've worked over the course of the last few years, we worked very closely with the Board of Accountancy to implement some of these streamlining measures that exist in many states so that we have laws that complement one another and make practice a little more streamlined, easier to do. So we've worked with them. Urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. Further pro-opponent testimony, House Bill 63. Seeing none, any opponent testimony? Seeing none, I'd open up to questions and or comments or action by the committee. Representative Wink.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would recommend move a do pass.
Second, moved by Representative Wink, second by Representative Gibson. Any comments on your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Lynn and Mr. Mann explained it very well. It's more cleanup legislation just to streamline the situation, and I think it's self-explanatory. And I'd ask you to support the motion.
Representative Feinstein.
Mr. Chair, I did have a question of the proponents, but can I ask that now since we bypassed
we
that?
We are past that, so you'll have to make a comment at this point on the motion for due pass.
Or procedurally, don't we have that option, sir?
Before us right now is the motion of due pass. It's been moved and seconded, and we're discussing the motion. Any discussion on the motion, Representative Feinstein?
No, I just feel that there's a question that had to be asked. I didn't know we discuss a bill before we go right into the motion. I did have a question, but I guess...
go ahead and state your question.
My question... Thank you, sir. Is if we talk to accountants, are there going to be any accountants out there that would oppose this or any CPA firms? And that's really...
We're a little bit out of order here, but we'll allow the question. Mr. Mann, go ahead if you want to address that.
We have worked with many of our members, accountants, and to my knowledge, there has been no objection to this. What it does in a lot of ways is it makes reporting much easier. Before you had to report all of the activities of the different accountants around the state, that became very problematic, costly. I know of no one that has opposed it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I think this was on consent calendar on the Senate. But any other comments on the motion do pass? Seeing none, those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Representatives Wink.
Aye.
Killer.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hoffman.
Aye.
Magstead.
Aye.
Kopp.
Aye.
Erickson.
Aye.
Stevens.
Aye.
Johns.
Aye.
Hayek.
Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
Gosch.
Aye.
That's 13 yeas, 0 nays.
13 ayes. The ayes have it. Senate Bill 63 will go to the floor with the due pass.
Mr. Speaker, I would move consent.
Representative Hayek moves consent. Second. Any objection? Senate Bill 63 will be placed on the consent calendar. That was seconded by Hoffman. Thank you, folks, for testifying today. With that, we will move to House Bill 1073, establish a procedure for the determination of the competency of a juvenile to proceed in a juvenile court matter. Mr. Satizon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Greg Satizon, legal counsel for the Unified Judicial System, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Chief Justice this morning. Currently in South Dakota law, there is no procedure for determining the competence of a juvenile that is subject to a delinquency or a CHINS petition. So what judges have been creative and done is attempted to apply the adult competency standards and then modify those to fit juveniles or kind of create their own procedure when this comes up as an issue. This proposal that's before you today has been borrowed from the adult competency but made to fit a juvenile setting after looking at how judges have handled that in our state and also what other states do with this issue. This proposal would create that mechanism in a case where a juvenile may have a competency issue that needs to be addressed. And this was brought to our attention by one of our circuit judges that has this happen
fairly frequently. It was more common than I thought it would be. But it is an issue that exists. There's approximately 7,200 juvenile case filings a year in South Dakota that this could apply to. This would only apply in a very small number of those. But when it's time to go through that process and to ensure the due process rights of that juvenile, to make sure the state understands what's expected of them, to make sure the defense attorney understands what's expected, this provides a good layout for everyone. And I'll just briefly walk through it. It starts with the proposition that, much like adult court, a court, that if you're not competent to understand the nature of the allegations and the proceedings against you and to assist your counsel in that matter, that there should not be a proceeding against you. It should be held in abeyance or suspended. And that the juvenile's competency can be raised at any time. It can be by the court on its own motion if it has reason to believe that there's an issue. The defense attorney may raise this or the state can raise it. And then once it's raised, the juvenile would be examined by a person that's licensed in psychology or psychiatry that has experience with the juvenile and would compare them to other juveniles of the similar age and developmental norms. And then a report would be generated from that that would go to all the parties, and a hearing would be required to be held to address the issue. And if the court determines that there is reasonable cause to go through this step, then it becomes the state's burden to show that the juvenile is competent to proceed by a preponderance of the evidence. So then what happens next? At that point, the court would make a decision, and the initial evaluation should be within 30 days, and the court would need to decide, is the juvenile competent to proceed? If the answer is no, then you would move toward disposing of the proceeding. If the answer is the juvenile may be likely to recover and be able to understand in the foreseeable future, then you can continue it, and they may undergo treatment, be provided medication, whatever it is that would render them competent. But it would have that occurring at set intervals. When you think about how juvenile court compares to adult court, juvenile court obviously involves younger people. Their developmental rate is much different. The intent of juvenile court is the rehabilitation of the juvenile. And so the timelines would move much quicker. There would be review at 60 days, 180 days, and then 1 year would be the outlier. And if at that time the court hasn't made a finding that the person would be competent in the foreseeable future, the proceedings would end. And as some of you may know, in adult court, if you're being held and competency is questioned and the maximum penalty is 25 years in prison, then they can hold you for 25 years until you've gained competence. So that model does not fit the juvenile court proceeding. And a juvenile court only has jurisdiction until 21 is the maximum there. So that's kind of a summary of what this does. I've worked very closely with the defense bar and also the state's attorneys and got a lot of feedback on this. And I think we've come up with a really good bill that would address this and provide a good mechanism that would be fair for all the parties and make sure everyone knows how this should proceed. And I believe there's going to be a few other proponents, but I'll stand by for any questions, certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Satizan. Any further proponents? House Bill 1073.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Ryder-Rabb, and I'm a registered lobbyist for the South Dakota Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. We, too, rise in support of this legislation, and I would just tell this committee that we certainly appreciate the fact that this was brought to one of the judges' attention and that they responded. There are issues that don't necessarily get addressed, and so we appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We also appreciate the opportunity to work with the unified judicial system to craft this legislation. Frankly, we had an opportunity to have a lot of input, so we appreciate that opportunity. We think what you see here today is a good bill, and I think the important thing is that it does address the specific needs of juveniles. There currently is not legislation that addresses the juvenile setting, much like we have in the adult system, so we certainly need a system in place. However, we also need to be aware of the fact that juveniles are different than adults, and the system is really geared towards rehabilitation instead of penalizing like the adult system. So we think the framework that you see before you today certainly addresses all of those dynamics. We also think that, I think this is an important thing, that while we as defense attorneys certainly are there to help our clients and be a resource and do and advocate on their behalf, they have to be able to assist us in their defense. And that's really kind of the heart of what competency is. And certainly think this bill addresses that issue very squarely. So we would support the passage of it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Ryder. I apologize. Any further proponent testimony? I just had your dad testify in state affairs, so... Mr. Bashan.
Thank you. Paul Bashan with the State's Attorneys Association. We likewise appreciate the opportunity to work with Mr. Sadezan and the UJS in crafting and formulating this bill. It's been a process that we've engaged in over a number of months. Let me give you just a brief backdrop as to competency. Judge Johns would be able to help me out with this if I forget that. When you're talking about competency, you're talking about two things. When you're dealing with adults. And what this bill does then is says we're also going to have to look at those two things when you're dealing with juveniles. The first is that the individual's able to understand the nature and the consequences of the proceedings against him. So they know what's going on in court. They know what they're charged with, or in a juvenile, they know what the petition, juvenile delinquency petition alleges. Secondly, they have to be able to assist in the defense. They have to be able to provide their attorney information and assist them by testifying, perhaps. And so those two things you look at for adults. What this bill does then is says we're going to have the same standard and requirements as we already do for juveniles, and we're going to create a process in which we can determine whether or not a juvenile is competent to proceed. And so to that extent, we believe this makes sense, and we support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bashan. Further proponent testimony, House Bill 1073.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. I am Emmett Reistroffer, Director and Lobbyist for South Dakota Families First, and I don't have much testimony today. We are happy to support this bill. We believe the judicial system is making a smart move for juvenile offenders who obviously have a vast difference of needs when they're in the criminal justice system. So with that, I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Mr. Beistroffer. Is that right?
Reistroffer.
Okay, thank you. Further proponent testimony, House Bill 1073. Seeing none, any opponent testimony? Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Killer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for Mr. Sebzal, please. Mr. Chair. Mr. Sebzal, I want to ask that if we're any Native communities or Native advocates consultant in this process, and one of the main reasons I ask is that, you know, half of my constituency is under 18, so I think that's, you know, a really valid concern for us, and most of it's on tribal, but at the same time, you know, we have, you know, young people who go back and forth for whatever reason, so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Killer, I consulted with the judges and the defense bar and the State's Attorney's Association. They may have members that practice in tribal court or involved with tribal members, but I didn't identify anyone to contact specifically.
Okay. And follow up, Mr. Chair. And I guess with that line of reasoning, so if there was a Native kid who lived on the reservation, went to let's say Rapid City or something like that, and then they, you know, something happened, so they ended up in this kind of process. Would there be, like, let's say, any cultural aspects or anything that would be taken into consideration at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the way this is structured, the court would refer to someone that's experienced in the area of evaluating juveniles and go through a number of different factors, and I think that examining the child and their age and their norms and their developmental skills would probably take into account, you know, their background, their cultural awareness, things like that. So I think that could be a part of it. There's nothing specific that speaks directly to that, though.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Stevens.
Thank you. When I look through this bill, the one thing that I guess that comes up to my mind is this, is that, you know, the definition of competency, you know, one of the speakers talked about that, but I don't really see that specifically in here. I mean, I see where in Section 6, you know, it says that these are things to assist the court's determination of competency, but what are you using specifically as a definition of competency? Because I know that you can be involuntarily committed to the South Dakota Human Services Center with a mental illness, but yet we have a specific state statute that says that in and of itself does not make you incompetent to even draft a will. So I guess I'm wondering where, what definition you're using, and if there shouldn't be one contained in this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevens, thank you for the question. The way this is structured, and I, at the outset, I would agree totally that the presence of a mental illness or a developmental disability does not mean that you're incompetent to proceed. It's just a factor or something that would be considered. But in Section 3, the term incompetent to proceed is defined by 23A10A-1. And so the way this is structured, and that's borrowing the adult definition, which, and I'll just read it really quickly, means the condition of a person who is suffering from a mental disease, developmental disability as defined, or psychological, physiological, etiological condition, rendering him mentally incompetent to the extent that he is unable to understand the nature and consequences of the proceedings against him or assist in his defense. And so the way it's structured is it doesn't define competence, it defines incompetence. And so if it's not established that you're incompetent, not competent to proceed, then by definition, you are competent to proceed. So it does it, I think, the opposite way of the way that you're trying to capture it.
Sure. Further questions? Representative Magstadt.
Yeah, you can sit right there. Last week, we sort of discussed this a little bit on that the mental illness definition. Were you able to sort of... Well, maybe I should preface this with a little bit of background. The mental illness definition, and it makes sense because it comes from the adult statute, is not applicable to kids under 18. And your diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders, most of those mental illnesses that are listed in there are not able to be diagnosed in children under 18 years old. The requirement is 18 and above. So what is the current statutes on the treatment side of the law is to place the diagnosis of serious emotional disturbance, which is defined in another statute. So, I mean, it's already there. But my assumption is that the court's not going to make the diagnosis of mental illness. They're going to go to a clinician and say, evaluate this juvenile for mental disturbances of some sort. But we're not allowing them to make the diagnosis by putting something on there that's not applicable to 18-year-olds. And I know we had that discussion last week, and I was just wondering about how that's going.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magstadt, thank you. And I did look into that. And my response would be that the mental illness part, the way that this is structured, it parallels the adult process. For juveniles and the commitment statutes – and the diagnostic statutes, I think, have to be viewed a little bit separately from this. If you look at the definition for mentally ill persons and the treatment of minors, it's severe emotional disturbance. And the way it's defined, it's 27A15.1.1, it lists five different things. Number one, under 18 years of age, exhibits behavior resulting in functional impairment. There's five of them. I won't read them all, but number three is the exact same definition we have for mental illness, which would be has a mental disorder diagnosed under the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So it's a factor in severe emotional disturbance. And I visited with the state's attorney and the defense attorney that have testified as well. And because this definition, I think, is intended for a broader purpose than the mental competency, I was very reluctant to just incorporate that definition into here. And as part of that chapter and that definition, it has a statement at the end saying, for purposes of this section, certain things, epilepsy, developmental disability, criminal or delinquent behavior, do not alone constitute serious emotional disturbance. And so I think the two definitions function in a very different way, and I appreciate you pointing that out. And I looked into it and tried to figure out how to make them fit together. But I think that having it defined this way, referring to the adult definition of incompetency, which includes things broader than mental illness, that would provide the guidance to the practitioners. I hope that answer makes sense.
Sure, follow up.
So that kind of keeps this a little more narrow ranged.
Mr. Chairman, that precisely, and that after discussing it with the other council, that was our intent as well, to keep the two things separate and keep this more controlled and defined.
Okay, Representative Stevens.
Yes. On page 5, which is your section 11, the sentence says that during this time the court may make orders that it deems appropriate for services that may assist the juvenile in attaining competency. Does that mean that this bill then would authorize a court as a part of that order to require the child to take psychotropic medication?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stevens, I believe that would require that if the court would order it.
Any follow-up? Okay, any further questions? Representative Hayek.
Mr. Speaker, this is kind of the cost. Who pays for it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is a statute that allows the cost to be it essentially says the parents have a duty to support, and so they have to pay. And they have to either reimburse Department of Social Services or the county or whoever would pay it if they don't make that payment. But the parents are on the hook under the entire umbrella of the juvenile chapter.
And follow-up? Then the UJS is totally out of it in terms of any of the costs if the court orders it. So back into the parents. And, of course, if the parents, it goes into the county.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Representative, that's correct. The UJS doesn't make payment on these.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Mr. Satizan, following Representative Stevens' question, under our current proceedings in these cases regarding making these kids take medications, has that been allowed for using the adult model, or has that been disallowed up until this point? Is that adding something new to what we've been doing?
Mr. Chairman, I think that the court before this statute would have had the authority to order that medication, and they certainly do under different procedures. In the adult context, I would say yes. I don't know if that's come up a lot in the juvenile proceeding, where they've had to order the psychotropic medication or force meds. But I think that this would allow it. I don't believe that's introducing anything new to the law.
Okay.
Any follow-up?
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Representative Stevens.
Well, can I ask our LRC staff this question? I mean, my recollection is when you have with the adults, when I've been involved with them, there's a regular procedure you have to go through before a court can order this. And, I mean, do you have any questions, issues of constitutionality, due process, with that kind of language in there?
Mr. Besplatz, do you wish to answer that question?
I really haven't researched this bill in depth. My participation in this particular problem is a style and form, and I certainly would not attempt to duplicate the effort that's gone in by the other people who have drafted the bill.
Mr. Satizan, any thoughts on that question?
No.
Other than constitutionality is determined by
I'm thinking about it and
your boss. So any further questions?
Chair, just as a point of information.
Representative Johns.
Thank you. Sometimes if it's not covered by statute, you have to resort to the inherent power of the court. So if it's not unconstitutional and it's reasonable, the court has the authority to proceed.
Okay, thank you for that. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Feinstein, last chance.
There's an opportunity to ask questions, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. See no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Satizan. Any comments from the committee and or action?
Mr. Chairman, I am really concerned about this because I think if adults have the right to object to having psychotropic medication forced upon them without first having a hearing. I don't know how we as a committee can force that on juveniles to do that by just merely an order of a court. I don't see anything in this procedure here that where the court even gets into, you know, taking testimony about what kind of treatment, whether they need, you know, the medication. So I have some concerns about that aspect of that.
Any further comments from the committee? And or action? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I guess I, you know, Mr. Satizan didn't seem too sure about the practices of today, and I would share the concern of Representative Stevens. You know, I would like to have more information on what we've been doing as far as, you know, forcing these juveniles to take medications if we have actually done such. I don't necessarily want to kill the bill. I think the intent is good, and I think most of the bill is good, but I would like to have some answers to that particular question.
Well, in light of your comments and Representative Stevens' comments and the lack of proposed action by the committee, why don't we defer this bill until Friday and give an opportunity for the proponents to get those questions addressed, and then we'll take action at that time. Any objection from the committee on that? Seeing none, we're going to defer House Bill 1073. Do we need a motion on that? No, we do not. We're going to defer House Bill 1073 to Friday, January 25th, at which point the representatives with the questions will seek to have them answered, and then we'll take action at that time. Thank you, members of the committee, and thank you, proponents and of this bill. With that, we will move to House Bill 1092, an act to revise certain provisions concerning the expungement of arrest records. It's my understanding this is going to go rather quickly. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, other members of the committee. In as much as we deferred that last bill because of my questions, I would only ask that 1092 be moved to the 41st day.
That will take quick action on that bill. Any further? Was that proponent or opponent testimony?
That was proponent. Opponent.
Okay. Any further proponents? House Bill 1092. Any opponents on 1092? I don't think we need to hear from anybody at this point. The prime sponsor, though, made it clear where he wants this bill to go. At this point, any action by the committee?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hansen called for it first. What do you?
Mr. Chair, move the table.
Motion to table is non-debatable. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Representative Wink. Non-debatable motion. Those in favor of tabling House Bill 1092 will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Representatives Wink?
Aye.
Killer?
No.
Feinstein?
No.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hoffman?
Aye.
Magstead?
Aye.
Kopp?
Aye.
Erickson?
Aye.
Stevens?
Aye.
Johns?
Aye.
Hayek?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
That'd be 11 yeas, 2 nays.
The ayes have it. House Bill 1092 is tabled. With that, we'll move on to our last bill, Senate Bill 37, an act to revise certain provisions regarding the Insurance Fraud Prevention Unit. Proponent testimony, Senate Bill 37. Mr. Attorney General, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, Marty Jackley, South Dakota Attorney General. When you look at Senate Bill 37, it deals with the Insurance Fraud Prevention Unit. That is a unit that was created in 1999 and has been under various agencies. It was under the Department of Labor as well as the Department of Revenue. What it is a law enforcement and prosecuting agency that deals with fraudulent insurance acts. A couple of examples, it might be when an insurance agent claims to sell a citizen of South Dakota insurance and never really does. That would be addressed by that. Or similarly, if a citizen basically tries to double dip on a hailstorm or something of that nature, then this unit would deal with that. This unit is comprised of three FTEs, and it's paid through the insurance industry assessments. In other words, it's not general fund taxpayer money. In 2011, by executive order and through the legislative appropriations process, the insurance fraud unit was placed under the Attorney General. The Division of Insurance agreed to that, and they've also agreed to these bill changes in Senate Bill 37. The unit has been under the Attorney General since 2011, has been working well. Just to update you, 109 referrals in 2012, 39 developed into investigations, 4 developed into indictments, and they spent quite a bit of effort on awareness. What Senate Bill 37 does is really cleans up the statutory language, placing the unit under the Attorney General as opposed to the Director of Insurance. And, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I certainly would make myself available for any questions regarding that.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Any further proponent testimony? Senate Bill 37. Ms. Barnett, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mallory Barnett here on behalf of the Department of Labor and Regulation, Division of Insurance. We've reviewed the bill and are in full support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponent testimony? Senate Bill 37, seeing none. Any opponent testimony? Seeing none. Any questions from the committee? Representative Wink.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General, you say your staff's been doing this since 2011. How does the FTE compare with what it was under the Division of Insurance? You have more or less the same?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wink, I think the answer is we have the same. The reason why I say I think that, it was three FTEs. The difference is before there was a unit attorney attached to the fraud division, and because I have 34 lawyers, I didn't take an additional attorney position. But I think in the reality is it was really operating as three FTE units before, and it's operating as three now. That may be the attorney explanation, may be some reason, and this is the appropriator hat. The budgeted was for $348,268 last year, and we spent $171,048. Now, that isn't saving taxpayer money. That saves the industry, but we've been able to do it, I think, efficiently because we have the in-house counsel available.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you. Open it up now to committee discussion and or action.
Mr. Speaker,
Representative Hayek.
Second.
Is that a due pass motion?
Due pass, thank you.
Move due pass by Representative Hayek, seconded by Representative Johns. Comments on your motion, Representative Hayek?
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, they're doing it, and so I appreciate the cleanup effort by the Attorney General, and they seem to be in the proper place to place it.
Any further comments by the committee on this motion for due pass? Further comments? Seeing none, question before the committee is the due pass motion. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Representatives Wink?
Aye.
Killer?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hoffman?
Aye.
Magstead?
Aye.
Kopp?
Aye.
Erickson?
Aye.
Stevens?
Aye.
Johns?
Aye.
Hayek?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
That's 13 yeas, 0 nays.
Senate Bill 37 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chairman, I would move that it go on the consent calendar.
Second.
No.
That is objected to. That will now go on consent. Representative Hayek, would you carry this on the floor? Thank you. With that, we have reached the end of our agenda. Reminder, House Bill 1073 will be deferred to Friday. With that, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Moved by Representative Wink, seconded by Representative Killer. Those in favor of adjourning, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. We are adjourned.